And it's a Wildcat.
Can you believe this?
First and goal at the two. Jalen Samuels, second-year man out of NC State. And this is going to be a touchdown. And that is Samuels just finding a crack and going straight ahead for the 2 yards and the score to put the Steelers up by double digits.
Yoy! Triple yoy! Triple yoy!
You're listening to Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
Myron Cope coming back from wherever he is now. Deceased. But with the yoy and double yoy and triple yoy. It's like he was watching Terry Bradshaw throw the ball last night when he was checking out Jalen Samuels.
Triple yoy.
Yes, that's a triple yoy. They've got two quarterbacks, a little quarterback controversy.
For sure there is.
Caleb Herring's with us, UNLV analyst. We got a quarterback controversy to talk about. Maybe not a controversy, but a debate. What's up, Caleb?
What's up? How you guys doing?
We're good, man. We're very good. Let's get into what's going on right now with UNLV at the quarterback position. First, let's back up and go to the game. Were you surprised that at the end of the first half that Kenyon Oblad came in and ran the two-minute offense, and then Armani came back in after that?
I was surprised. I mean, I think Armani's run the two-minute offense before, and this season he's run it effectively, albeit against Southern Utah. They got some points at the end of the half against them with him running the two-minute drive. So I think it's kind of surprising because Armani's run the two-minute drill. It's not like he's 4-2. He's not like he's never done it before. So it's a little bit. It was surprising at that moment to see him come in, and he come in at that moment. Of course, Coach Sanchez explained later that Oblad had, you know, taken the reps on the two-minute drive, possibly because he's a better passer, as we saw later in the game, you know, maybe more proficient or capable in the passing game with accuracy and things like that. So, I mean, his explanation was what it was, but it was surprising in that moment because then there was another series when there's time left in the half where Armani gets back out there, and that's the series where he ends up getting injured. So it definitely felt a little weird, you know. And as a former quarterback, I know that's kind of a strange situation to do. You know, you're following what your coach is saying. He's saying this guy's going to get the next reps. You're not sure if you're going to get back in the game with all the things that have been swirling in the media about maybe you not being the answer as quarterback. So for Armani getting put on the bench for that series may have felt a little different, I think, than intended by Coach Sanchez. And I think the general fans of the Rebel football that watched that probably had the same kind of feeling. Well, now it's Kenyon's turn. Maybe he's taking over. So, and then, of course, the rest of the second half that came after that kind of would lead you to believe that even further. So, tough situation. It was surprising, to say the least, that to see Kenyon get in the first half last week.
What did you like? What did you dislike in that second half from Kenyon Oblad?
Well, I like a lot about Kenyon. I like his delivery. I like his presence in the pocket. I like his downfield pass-first quarterbacking style. I think you saw that some of the plays, not just throwing from the pocket, but extending plays not to run, but extending plays to find an open receiver downfield. He wasn't very effective and didn't complete a lot of passes on those extended plays, but you see his mentality as a pass-first guy come through in plays like that. And surprisingly, he wasn't as rattled as I would have assumed him to be as a young quarterback in his first real time against ones in a conference game like that on the road in a hostile environment. I was actually pleasantly surprised by the way he handled himself composure-wise. He had a couple of ugly incompletions in the first quarter in the first half when he first got in. Those two incompletions in a row that were just terrible throws. He kind of composed himself, though, in the second half and came back out and delivered some pretty accurate, tough completions. Some of those balls up and over defenders were nice and right on the money. He had a cover two corner to Randall Grimes that he put on a dime and was moving the ball effectively through the air. But those things were kind of what I knew about him already. I've said it before that he's probably the best pure passer of the quarterback stock that UNLV has right now, but will need time to develop. And you saw some of the things later, like the two interceptions, those errant passes that he threw. Those are young mistakes that you can avoid if you have some experience. But hopefully that experience comes in time because he's a bright spot for the future, I think, at quarterback.
So where do they go from here in your mind?
That is the toughest question. And it gets even tougher because Armani's not 100% right now. So to me, I feel like what Armani presents to you as an offense, it's more productive for Armani, as in healthy Armani at least, to cater your offense to Armani and be a run-dominant team and pass when necessary and lean on Armani to be efficient in those spots and live or die with that. I think that is probably still the best bet if you have a healthy Armani and, of course, also a healthy Charles Williams. This week, neither of those things are true. Like, Armani and Charles are practicing, but they're not 100% clearly. Both of them may not be 100% by Saturday. It's kind of a touch-and-go thing. But either way, I think they're not 100% by game time. So you might be looking at a situation that Kenyon Oblad is the best because you now have to gear your offense towards that. And the good thing is you have the receiving core that's capable and talented to support him. But you might have to have a wholesale offensive shift to be ready for Kenyon to take over. And I think that's what makes this a little bit harder, is that not having 100% Armani to make the decision a little easier. Because I think, in my opinion, Armani still gives the best chance to win just the way the offense is structured and how Tony wants to run his offense and has run his offense with a lot of design quarterback run and using the quarterback run as a threat. I mean, going back to when Blake Decker and Kurt Palandek and Johnny Stanton and all the quarterbacks that Coach Sanchez has had since he's been here have been running quarterbacks and have had that threat in his offense. If you don't have that, the offense is completely different than it's been over the years, and that's what would have to happen if Kenyon was to take over. So I still think a healthy Armani is your best bet to winning.
Caleb Herring, analyst on radio, covering UNLV football. All right, going back to the Wyoming game, I mean, you could talk about this for a while. What's wrong with the defense, and what was the problem with the tackling?
Oh, my kid, it was just poor technique. And I think that's a lot of it is just you can only teach these days so much. When you're, you know, going live reps against each other in fall camp, you have limited time with pads and all the things. There's one-a-day practices now. So the technique stuff is not – you want to skim through it as much as you can and hope the guys are sticking to it, the fundamentals. And if it's not second nature, I think there's a couple guys on defense that I could say right now that have tackling down, like Farrell Hester and Rayshard Jackson, who typically don't miss tackles. But there's a lot of guys on the defense that just don't have – the fundamentals ingrained enough to be consistent when they're tired, when they're out of position, when they're when you know the play doesn't unfold perfectly for them, that don't get in the right position to make tackles and don't finish tackles. So that's just a personal thing you got to work at and drill more. I think for a team like UNLV, it needs to be like a priority at best during camps and during the season even. But tackling is a huge problem defensively. It's just there were so many times that there was a run that there were six broken tackles. A couple of guys had two chances to make a tackle on that run and end up being a 40-plus yard gain. So things like that just can't happen defensively. You have to be able to tackle. That's the fundamental. It's a principle of defense. You have to be able to tackle. And if you don't, then teams will do what Wyoming did to you.
So, Caleb, it sounds like Tony Sanchez is going to make some changes on the offensive line too, left tackle and right tackle. Justice Olawashone is going to go from right to left, and then Justin Polu, who's been a guard his whole career, is going to go to right tackle.
Yeah, so that to me is indicative of how much bigger the problem is. I know that the headlines always are about the quarterbacks, and it's been so for the whole season, like Armani or Kenyon. When do you pull the trigger on that? But there's been a lot more going wrong with UNLV offensively than just the quarterback, and that shuffling of the offensive line kind of indicates that, because they've not been able to protect either quarterback. I mean, Kenyon was running for his life a few times back there in the pocket. Armani's been sacked quite a bit, been hit. The run game hasn't been able to find its traction like it was expected to, and really has been carried by Charles Williams and the things that he can do with the ball in his hand on some individual effort basis. So moving those things around. But I think it's also an indicator that maybe the scheme of the offense will be changing. And trying to get – anytime you try to get your tackles to be the best, you know, of the offensive line, mm-hmm. usually that's an indicator that you're going to be passing the ball a little bit more. So having, you know, moving those guys to the outside and getting some help at that tackle position, maybe because tackles are on an island during drop back passes. So maybe that's an indicator that UNLV is looking in the direction of a Kenyon style offense where there's a lot more passing involved.
What's the message? I mean, I think you early in the season, if you're struggling, you say, hey, we'll focus on conference play and, you know, it's a new start for us. But now you go into conference play, you get blown out in your first game. What does the message become?
I mean, at this point in the season, it still can be. It's early because conference play is one game in. There's still a whole conference schedule ahead of you where there's no time to be, I guess, down on yourself now. I mean, it's still early, but you don't have time, if that makes sense. Like there's a lot to play for at this point. but it's on you now. It's time to turn it on right now. There's no waiting. You know, there's no bye week to bail you out right now. We're not going to get another reset button. So if you keep messing this up, you're going to find yourself in a world of trouble at the end of the season. So the time is now, but there's still a lot to play for. And I think that's got to be the message right now, because if you get too, you know, if you push the panic button as a coach and your message comes from a place of sheer, we got to figure something out now, immediately, then your team starts to feel that. So I think you still have to keep it in perspective that it's a long season. There's a lot to be played. I mean, a third of your games have been played. You still got, you know, or a quarter of the games have been played. You still got three more quarters of football, if you want to break it down, you know, in that sense, that you have to play. And there's still a lot. I mean, you could finish conference with however many games left, 8-1 in conference, I guess. So that, I mean, that's still a possibility. But is it realistic? I'm not sure about that. But there's still a lot of football to be played, and you can't give up on the season as some fans or some critics or skeptics would have you believe. It's time to throw in the towel right now.
Well, I mean, if you're, you know, going to put that pipe dream out there of going 8-1 in conference, that means a win over Boise State. That becomes fairly difficult.
Yes, fairly difficult. I mean, but you play. I mean, the message of winning, of playing 13 is like, I mean, you never, as a team, want to put a number to your season anyway. So every week you go out to play, you're expecting to win, or you want to win at least. Your desire is to win, and there's nothing wrong with telling your team that the goal is to win. And no matter, we're not gonna, you know, rest our starters this week just because we don't think, you know, or the odds don't say that we're gonna win. You still want to go out there with your best effort and try to get a win, because you never know, especially with the way college football has gone this year. I mean, Boise State's had a win that nobody expected against Florida State. You know, San Jose State beating Arkansas. Those things have happened, so it's not too far-fetched, but you just want to make sure your guys have the right mindset when they go out there. Otherwise, there's no point in suiting up if you're going to defeat yourself as a team. Now, outside, we can all say, yeah, Boise's probably going to take it to them on Saturday, but in-house, you have to be completely 100% confident that you can play with the opponent across from you.
The voice of Caleb Herring on Cofield and Company. Let's close on this. You played the game, so you have firsthand experience. What do you think about what California did with its law? You know, it's a little ways down the road, but they're going to allow players to collect money via endorsements.
You know, personally, I love it. I love that, you know, this, I think it's overdue. I think there's been a reason to want this or desire this from a player standpoint, and I think it's kind of just a fair thing to have your name and your likeness be profitable to you. It doesn't make sense for it to be wholly profitable to only institutions and the NCAA. So I've always been an advocate for players, and that doesn't change. And this is one of the steps in the right direction. Of course, for it to truly be effective, it needs to expand more than just California. But I'm definitely on board with the player being able to take ownership of his own likeness and profit from it as he can and maximize his own potential. I think, you know, there's a lot that details that had to be figured out, but this is a good first step in achieving a fair system for the athlete. And oftentimes they get lost in these kind of debates. It becomes about fair, open competition. And I think about stories like, you know, the guy from Central Florida, I tweeted about him. He's making YouTube, and got famous, getting paid for it. And he's forced to quit because, you know, the NCAA, he can't do it because of NCAA compliance rules. And those kind of stories are, you know, not as glorified or magnified, but they happen. And I think it's important that in this country, in this capitalist country, that people are able to maximize their opportunities. And I think for the 4 years or 5 years that a player is playing on this stage, on this platform, they have a rare opportunity to exploit, if you will, their own talents and their own name. And I don't see any reason why the NCAA or any institution should be able to block that. So kudos to California for getting the ball rolling on it, and hopefully some other states follow suit to make it an even and fair playing field for all of college athletes.
I saw you chatting about the topic on Twitter, and I saw you talking to someone saying, I also don't like the American model of athletics. Sports being tied to education at every level is complicated.
It is. And I think, you know, you look at, I hate to say it, but the LaVar Ball model here, where he sent his kids overseas to play. He's a teenager, but he's able to play professionally and earn money doing the job without the attachment of having to be eligible for school, for one, or the school sanctions or rules applying to them. You know, there's people that maybe don't have an interest in school and maybe have a talent that is so, you know, have a skill, even not just sports related, but have a skill that, you know, there's a market for, and they want to exploit it. Well, in America, the best pipeline to get into a professional career athletics-wise is through the school system. And it's ingrained in you since, you know, from after-school programs and all of that in high school, where you go get recruited and go to a college and your education is tied to it. And then the education is used always in the argument of, well, you're being compensated by your education being paid for. Well, a lot of guys, most guys, will tell you that the goal for them is to achieve professional sports and to make a living playing that sport. I think we should invest more as a country, and this is like, you know, maybe some details need to be ironed out, but invest more as a country into those amateur leagues or those semi-pro leagues that give us a chance to play sports without necessarily having the restrictions of being a student athlete and the tedious lifestyle that can create for students and athletes. You never get the best of one world. You always have to be split between the two. So I always felt like they're, you know, looking at other countries, it could be a beneficial thing. And I think the pros are starting to look at it. You look at all the guys coming from European leagues. You get a better quality athlete when they do achieve professional life if they have, you know, experience playing at even an amateur or semi-pro level. So, I mean, it's one of those things that I think the NCAA, being an institution that's just been around for so long, we never questioned if it was right or if it was the best option. And now we're at this crossroads where maybe the NCAA is being revealed for something that we didn't think it was. And things like this California bill, are kind of chipping away at it. And maybe that's not a bad thing.
All right, Caleb, good job. We'll see you tomorrow.
All right, we'll see you. Take care.
There you go. Caleb Herring, former UNLV quarterback, doing radio covering the Rebels. Our Football Insider Spot is brought to you by Born and Raised Las Vegas and in Henderson. They've got the football game specials on Bud, Bud Light, and Mick Ultra. Bucket specials with Bon and Viz Spike Seltzer. Also that Stoli, Bloody Mary, Mango Michelada. And great breakfast. They have great food 24/7. The multiple time winner in the best of for sports bars and taverns in terms of food. You can grab the Hender Tucky Toast for breakfast, the Loco Moco, or the Aloha Breakfast Sliders. Born and raised, Las Vegas location on Durango between, on Warm Springs between Durango and Buffalo, and right there by St. Rose and Eastern in Henderson.
Finley Toyota, they'll do anything to sell you a car. No Toyota problem is too tough, too large, or too small. Keep your Toyota running like a Toyota.
You're talking about a Cincinnati Bengals team that might be the second worst team in all of football. They are horrible. That offensive line should be ashamed of themselves. They should be giving the Bengals money back. That was really no test last night.
Now, back to Cofield and Company in the Finley Toyota Studio.
Yeah, that kind of performance is ready-made for hot take, hot shots. We love Stephen A. Are the Bengals the second worst team in the NFL?
I don't know.
It's pretty good competition right now.
There's a lot of bad teams out there.
There are a lot of bad teams. It's a mess. We want to talk a little football. We want to talk about UNLV of past days and also what's going on with the Rebel football program now. Good guy to lean on. He's got broadcast experience, of course, experience as a Rebel. One of the all-time great receivers in the history of the school. They're going to be celebrating the 90s this weekend. That game against Boise as they say farewell to Sam Boyd Stadium, as Randy Gatewood is up with Cofield and Company here in Vegas. How you doing, buddy?
I'm amazing, man. Thanks for having me on. It's good to be on with you guys.
Well, I love the positive attitude, so let's see if we can do what we do to everyone. Let's bring it down a little bit. Who is the second worst team in football next to the Dolphins? Is it the Bengals?
It's absolutely the Bengals. Okay?
Oh, man.
Let me go back. It's probably close, because I think that Washington Redskins team is pretty bad too, you know. So it's definitely a toss between the Bengals and the Redskins, but I give the edge to the Bengals right now. They're pretty bad,
and they're dissimilar, but they're similar in terms of the coaching situations. Because I wonder what it's like as a player when you're with a first year guy like Zach Taylor, and you're looking around, you're like, I don't think this guy knows what he's doing. And then on the Redskins side, you got Jay Gruden, and you know as a player, he's probably done.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, like, and they're two different situations, because Zach Taylor just came in. You know, they brought him in to try to right the ship after Marvin Lewis was gone, and now you look at how that team is functioning right now, and it's obviously not right. Like, they can't do anything right. And as a first-year coach, you got to be able to reach those players to where it looks like you at least know what you're doing. Right now, they don't have any idea. Cincinnati has no idea what they're doing, and Redskins, it's a sad situation, because I know Jay Gruden very well, You know, he played in the Arena League. We played against him for years, and, you know, for a while he had a good thing going out there. But now it seems like he's lost that football team too. And right now they're just not – no one is enthused about going out and playing. No one's interested in making big plays. And he's got his hands full right now, and he's on a very, very hot seat right now. Matter of fact, his butt's probably burning a little bit right now.
You mentioned kind of losing a locker room. We hear that expression all the time, but – Once that happens, is there any way coaches can get it back?
I don't think so. No. Once the coach has lost the pulse of the locker room, you can't get it back. You have to, as a coach coming in, you have to come in and you have to demand a certain level of respect from your players. And when a coach loses the locker room, they've lost respect for you as a coach. And for you to gain that back, it's very, very hard to do. A lot of people, and I'm sure there may have been a handful of people who've done it, but I don't know too many coaches that have been successful once, you know, those players have lost the respect and they don't want to play hard for you anymore. And it's a job more than it is having fun. It's very hard to get it back. I mean, look at this Giants situation. You know, for a while we thought that coming into this season they were going to be awful, and you know, people were talking about Eli this and Eli shouldn't be there and Daniel Jones, why did they draft him? And I felt like Pat Shurmur had lost that locker room until Daniel Jones just came in. And now Daniel Jones has kind of saved, I think, that whole Giants team, at least for right now so far. So, but yeah, it's really hard to gain it back once you've lost the command and the respect of those players.
And going back to talking about Zach Taylor as well, up in Cincinnati, How long of a leash do coaches have in your mind? Like, obviously he comes in, he wants to establish a culture, he wants to do, you know, some new things and put his own stamp on things there. But all of a sudden you're four games in and everybody's looking around like, is this really what we're signed up for right now?
Yeah, and me, that's – teams wouldn't want me as a GM, you know, because I'm telling you, I am hard. And me and some of the guys have this discussions all the time about football and – player personnel and all that type of thing, and I am really, really hard on head coaches. And unfortunately, you know, if this is how it's going, he would be on a very, very short leash. Like, I would be looking at candidates, you know, right now to succeed him probably in the next year or so if something doesn't turn around. Because going into this thing as a coach, you have to have the power to go in and at least gather these guys, handle all these different personalities, and make sure that you put something presentable on the field. And right now, they look bad. They look really bad. So if I'm a GM of the Bengals, Zach Taylor's on a very short leash right now.
The voice of former UNLV receiver Randy Gatewood, who is going to be the honorary captain for 90s night against Boise on Saturday. I want you to set up for the audience that isn't familiar with UNLV football in terms of history. What was going on September 17th, 1994, when you seemed to catch everything in the yard?
You know, it's funny because we came into that season riding like we were really high. We just took on, just got a brand new coaching staff. My junior year, we went like 3-9 or something like that.
Yeah, you guys were 3-8.
3-8. And then my senior year, we come back with a whole new different staff, whole new everything. And going into spring ball, we were really excited about it. We were throwing the football, you know, 40, 50 times a game. And so going into that season and that night, we had had a little success with the first couple of games of the season. And that night, and it's crazy because Jared Brown starts the game. He throws for a ton of yards. And he goes into a little bit of a lull about, I want to say, midway through the second quarter or something. We switch quarterbacks at halftime. Jason Davis comes in, and he catches fire. Like, I mean, and that night, everything he threw to me, I caught. And I seemed to always be open. And it was one of those magical nights where I think even at time, the quarterback found himself, like, looking for me. Like, hey, you know, let's keep this thing going. And Henry Bailey actually had a huge night that night as well. But with the 23 catches, you know, 363 yards, and everything that I was able to do that night, it was just overshadowed by all of it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Big
season.
And
I remember being on the sideline. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you.
Yeah, no, keep going, keep going.
And we were in the fourth quarter, late in the fourth quarter, and I remember Coach Horton at the time, you know, I'm running out to the side to line up, and he yells at me, and I really don't have any idea that I'm even close to this record, you know? And Coach Horton yells at me. He goes, Gatewood, don't just tie the record, break the damn thing, you know? And so I knew that there was some hype and people started to talk about it in the fourth quarter. And by the end of the night, you know, I had rolled up all these catches and all these yards and everything. And it was unfortunate because we lost the game. We got down by a ton of points. We almost won it, but we just ran out of time. But it was a magical night, and it kind of put me on the map that year as far as college football, because I went on to lead college football, like to lead the nation in yards and catches up until the last game of the year. A guy out of Wyoming, I want to say Marcus Robertson, Marcus something, he ended up catching me. And me and Alex Van Dyke, who was a Reno guy, we were right there neck and neck as well. But it really put me on the map that year because I ended up going out and catching, having a huge year back in 1995.
88 catches, 1,203 yards. How did you land at UNLV? You were JUCO in Texas, but how'd you land at UNLV?
Yeah, I spent 2 years at a junior college in Tyler, Texas, which was great experience. We won two junior college championships down there. I almost had another chance to play for another national title, and we lost the regular season game during the season to Northeastern Oklahoma, who went on to win the national junior college title that year. So, but that set me up, and UNLV was recruiting me. I had UNLV, I had Baylor, I had a couple of other teams in Texas who were looking at me as well. And me being from Texas, I had really never left the state of Texas until I went to Las Vegas. And so I land in Vegas, and I see bright lights and, you know, a university and college football. And it was one of those things where it was the right fit. I really liked the coaches at the time who were recruiting me, and we only had them for 1 year. I had a friend on the team from junior college who had a full ride from the year before. So there was a lot of familiarity with some of the people in that organization already. And they had lost a lot of wide receivers that next year. So I was set up to play right away, and I ended up, you know, signing a scholarship with them, going in and having just a really, really good run with them that year. And it was a fun year. We went on to the Las Vegas Bowl that year, won that game. You know, prior to that, I don't know, it had been a while since the Running Rebels football team had been to a bowl game, and we ended up winning that game, avenging a loss to Central Michigan, who beat us earlier that year as well. It was a really fun year, fun time, you know, a lot of memories from those 2 years at UNLV.
You went on to have an amazing career in the Arena Football League. Now, I'm sure everyone's dream, you know, coming out of college is, hey, I want to play in the NFL. What did you first think when the AFL was a possibility? Were you fired up for it, or were you kind of leery of the league?
I didn't want to play arena football at first. And I, you know, Hunky Cooper, who was another UNLV guy, was already involved in arena football, and I did not want to play arena football. So he tried to talk me into trying out for the Rattlers because he was coming out with some other guys who were trying out. They were having an open tryout, and I told him, no, you know, I'm going to try to get back to the NFL. I had been cut by the Miami Dolphins the previous season before, and I felt like I should have made that team as well. And there was no doubt that I knew I had the ability to play on Sunday. But once I did give the Arena Football League a chance, I came and Arizona wanted to sign me, so I played that year with them. And then a year later, I met my future wife. And so once we met, we decided, you know, we're going to make a family, we're going to do all this type of stuff. And I chose not to even try to go back to the NFL after that. You know, I could stay here, I could wake up to my kids, I could wake up to my family. It was a different ball game for me at that point. But there's no doubt I had the ability to play on Sunday, but I just chose a different route so that I could be there for my wife, my kids, and everybody at the time.
How tough was it picking up the defensive side of things?
You know, I made the transition fairly easy because coming out of high school, I actually had some offers to play defensive back and wide receiver. So in high school, I played both ways. And I was used to playing defensive back because, like I said, I played it pretty much throughout all of my high school career, especially my junior and senior year. And so to make that transition back to it once I got to the AFL, it really wasn't that hard. And me having a full understanding of what wide receivers are thinking and what they're doing and how they're going to try to set me up in those type of things, it gave me an advantage over them because I knew what they were trying to do. And with the confines of the Arena Football League field, they could only do a few things, you know. But it, all that experience from back in high school, it did. It gave me an edge, and I went on to be very successful in the AFL on offense and defense.
You still have to pick up the those weird motions, though. That looks impossible.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it's some people don't realize that the Arena Football League is all about angles. You know, you can only he can only do so much. Even though he's coming downhill at you full speed in motion, you got a little bit of help from the cornerback as well. You know, and he can only do so much with that head of steam. And a lot of guys, believe it or not, once you're running that fast, a lot of guys can't get out of cuts. There was very few guys who could get out of cuts coming downhill like that, and they were very tough to cover. But some of the other guys, none of them really understood the art of running routes, you know. And for me, not being a blazer and not being like a super fast guy, I understood the art of running routes. And that's why I always felt like no matter who was on me, whether he was a 4-3, 4-4, whatever he was, he wasn't going to cover me because I understood the art of running routes.
Randy Gatewood's with us. What do you think about the future of UNLV football with the facility on the way and the stadium next year?
I love it, man. I love it. They came a long, long way, you know, since the days of us, you know, being there. And, you know, the uniforms have changed. They got a million different uniforms now. You know, I see them on TV, and I see pictures of photos of things that come to me and stuff. And the program looks absolutely amazing, and I'm sure it's in great hands with Sanchez there now, and the way that they're doing things now, they're getting some really, really good players. And so I the sky's the limit for them now. You know, it's just a matter of them now getting a few more, you know, big time players, some big time recruits to come and play there, you know. But based on, you know, how it was when we were there, wow, the transition has been completely, completely different and amazing since we were there.
Randy, we appreciate a couple minutes. We'll see you out there on Saturday. Congrats on the honors of being the honorary captain.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys. Yeah, and thanks for having me on, and I look forward to seeing you guys this weekend.
There you go, Randy Gatewood, former Rebel receiver, still the NCAA record holder, 23 receptions. Ready for this from the quarterback? How about these numbers? 28 of 41, 347 yards. In the fourth quarter.
Wow.
They were down 45-10.
Oh,
28 of 41, 347.
Like 16 or to Gatewood?
He had 207 yards receiving in the fourth quarter.
That's incredible. I was actually just after I had moved here a few months, and I remember thinking, like, wow, this is what UNLV football is going to be like. It's going to be fun to watch. It's going to be great.
It's pure lunacy, right?
Oh, those were the days. And the Sam Boyd, at the time, the turf was just awful to where, it, like, the middle of the field was so much higher than the sidelines. And, I mean, we played there in high school, and it was like, stunning. Like, you, if you were running from the middle of the field to the sideline, you'd be running straight downhill. It was crazy. Those were the days.
You and your rec specs all fogging up.
Couldn't see where I was going.
All stumbling downhill.
Tripping everywhere. It was great.
Let's give away some Golden Nugget 52 Fridays concert tickets. This Friday, big show. Don McLean. 8 o'clock start. 364-1100, 364-1100. Two pairs of tickets to two different people. Trivia, though. And Ari's not giving you the question on the phones. All right? 364-1100, 364-1100. Don McLean, 52 Fridays. This guy was like the modern-day NBA player coming into the league. He was a one-and-done. You know that?
Wow.
Right? See, it works. You know, when you don't play basketball, people are like, oh, that's fine. Be a one-and-done. Don McLean went to school for less than a year and was like, you know what? Time to go pro. What school did he go to? Legendary musician Don McLean. What school did he go to? 364-1100, 364-1100. He was a one-and-done. I'll give you a hint. The school has won a national basketball title in the last 25 years, so that narrows the field a little bit. So you're talking about a major name university. The school has won a national title in the last 25 years. Where did Don McLean Not the one at UCLA, the musician, right? You hear the song. He's going to be playing the Golden Nugget 52 Fridays concert series this Friday. Two pairs of tickets, 3-6-4-1100.
Visit Cofield's Corner on LVSportsNetwork.com for access to the latest podcasts and best interviews.
Thing about it, we're kind of in a quadrant right there because they're so different. Armani is a running quarterback. Run first, you know, pass second, you know. Those, he threw some good balls tonight, did a good job. Kenyon is the opposite. I mean, he's your drop back passer, you know. So if Armani is not healthy, you know, if he can't run around out there, it kind of limits the things that we can do, you know, schematically. You know, we call the game differently when he's in, is what I'm saying.
Now, back to Cofield and Company in the Findlay Toyota Studio.
All right, rolling on here just past the halfway point on a Tuesday. Adam Hill, Steve Cofield, Ari. All right, we're going to be talking about this much of the week, and I didn't get your opinion yet. What do you think they should do at quarterback? That was Tony Sanchez on the way back against a powerhouse in Boise. Can you answer it without knowing where Armani Rodgers is in terms of health?
No, not really. I mean, I think if Armani Rodgers is questionable or injured at all, I think you just go with Oblad. But this is such a unique situation. It just really is. Like, you want to think about the future. Like, this is the time of year you're thinking about the future. What are we going to do next year? What are we going to do down the road? Do we want to develop a guy to get ready for next year?
But
there's a very good chance that the current coaching staff is not going to be there.
All right, the coaches fighting and the staff are fighting for their jobs. How do you set yourself up in the best way to win? To me, and Caleb Herring mentioned this 15 minutes ago, they've made a change at both tackle positions. They're sliding over the right tackle to left tackle. They're sliding out the right guard to right tackle. They're throwing the ball.
Yeah.
So that would lead you to believe that Kenyon Oblad's going to play a lot.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, you're changing the makeup of your offensive line, and you're putting your best players at tackle. That signals that you're going to start throwing the ball more, which would lead you to believe Oblad's in there, whether it's because of injury or because that's just the decision they've made. But again, to me, it almost would be you have to have Oblad involved because you want to develop him. You want to continue to get him action. I just think that they're in a unique situation where that really doesn't necessarily apply.
I think, and again, another guy, we need to know the health situation of Charles Williams. Word is that he's going to try to play on Saturday. I just can't imagine that he's 100%. This is now a throwing football team. It just is. And it's not what you really want against Boise. I mean, it's very dangerous, you know, young quarterback, but they're going to have to throw it all over the yard without a healthy Charles Williams.
Yeah.
And they don't have the problem is, like, hey, there were other guys at the beginning of the season who could step in and play running back. Now the rest of the core is all dinged up.
Yeah. And with your defense the way it is, I mean, that makes you think about being more of a throwing team as well, because you're in a spot where you know you're going to have to score a ton of points. You're not going to be able to use a ball control game where you run the ball, get some stops, establish a run, play from ahead, you know, play from the lead, all those other things. You're going to be chasing points pretty much every week if your defense continues to play the same way. So you have to adjust your thinking from that regard too.
Up next, we go behind the counter. We'll go down to the TI and talk to the fellas at the Sportsbook inside the TI. Of course, tomorrow, live show at the Golden Circle Sports Bar.
Join the conversation on Twitter at Cofield & Co.
And Dahl cracks one deep right center. And to the wall. It's out of here. Doug Smith back from the injured list. His first at bat in 2 months. And he hits a walk-off home run in the season's final game. Oh, the Never Say Die Mets finish the season on an incredible note.
Now, back to Cofield and Company in the Findlay Toyota Studio.
Incredible! Really a meaningless game for the Mets, except, by the way, Gary Cohen's awesome. That guy is a top five play-by-play guy. That's the Mets' P-by-P voice that actually pushed the Mets over for the season win total.
Maybe that's why he was so excited.
I was thinking, I'm like, hey, maybe Keith Hernandez couldn't speak. Keith's like, hey, the over!
I'm Keith Hernandez.
This is incredible. Gary Cohen, even more fired up. Had a couple of dimes on the over. No, probably not.
No.
Just enthusiastic and a professional. All right, speaking of enthusiastic and a professional, let's go down to the TI. Let's find out what's going on early in NFL betting. Paul Imondi is on the horn. What's up, buddy?
Hey, Parley Paul in the house. Thanks for having me.
All right. All right. We're going to concentrate on the NFL, so let's go rapid fire here. First of all, your personal opinion on the Ravens and Steelers line, especially after we saw what the Steelers did last night, and how are people betting it early in the week? The Ravens are 3.5.
Down to 3 at some joints, which juice doesn't surprise me. I think this is going to be possibly back and forth. You know, 3 Ravens, 3.5 Steelers, and then, you know, we'll see where it ends up on Sunday.
Bears-Raiders going to stay at Bears -5 in London?
This is a tough one, and, you know, for the Raiders fans, away, London, bye, away, and away. So I don't know who's doing the great scheduling in the NFL, but they're really not getting any breaks here. Bears might float up to 6.
Wow. What difference does Trubisky not playing make in the line?
The coach was a Nagy. Not as much trust in Trubisky. They can open up the playbook a little bit more, and I think Chicago will do it.
Wait, so what we're asking here is generally we can talk about, hey, you go from the starter to the backup. What's the difference in the line? I'm getting the impression that there's almost no difference between, from an odds maker standpoint, Trubisky to Daniel.
Oh, right. I guess there shouldn't be much of a difference. But again, would this be as high as 7 with Trubisky? Maybe. Tough to say at this point, though. Yeah, he's going to go up to 6.
I actually think it's the other way. I think Daniel's worth more than Trubisky.
Well, at this point, like, if it's he can use the playbook more, sure.
It's incredible. It really is. We're talking to Paul Imondi from down at the TI. He's working in the sports book. We're going to be out there at the Golden Circle Sports Bar tomorrow with a 3 o'clock start for Cofield and Company. All right, we got another big spread out there. We'll see if you're getting any sharp action. Anyone biting on the Redskins +15.5 against the Patriots?
They don't know what to do at this point. I'm sure we're going to get more Patriot money for sure. A few small plays so far, but, I mean, the Redskins don't even know if they're going to start a possible hurt Colt McCoy, you know, versus their healthy options. They're at a tough point right now. Not a lot of confidence.
Jets-Eagles. There's got to be a little money coming in on the Jets because I saw last night I thought the Eagles were around 14.5. It's at 13 now.
Floated down 13.5, then I saw 13 with juice. It's remained there for most of the afternoon.
Falcons and Texans. I have no idea how to read the Texans anymore. They're 5.
I also like them versus Carolina this past weekend. Yeah, Atlanta, you don't know. They're as wishy-washy as it gets. This should be really between 4.5 and 5.5, unless there's a late injury or something. That's a pretty square number.
We talk all the time about not overreacting, and we see, you know, odds boards are much slower to react to teams than the general public is because everybody just freaks out over one performance. But how long into a season can you start saying, like, okay, we're not overreacting, maybe this team isn't as good as we thought they were?
Oh, well, Tony here says it best. You know, September's over. The second preseason's over. Now, you know, let's get the real football started. So I'm sure in the next week or so, especially with a couple of big games this week, we're going to be able to weed out the pretenders.
So Buffalo goes to Tennessee. Tennessee laying 3 here. I know the look-ahead line was closer to pick 'em or 1. How much of this maybe has to do with Josh Allen being out? Because I can make another case that Barkley might be better than Allen here, too.
Right. A lot of people loved what they saw, and I know that was one I actually predicted. Buffs got the stuff. Defense is for real. They showed up again against the Patriots. Allen, you know what? 3, it could be low scoring. I know it's a low total. I want to see what the Titans do. They say Mariota firing on all cylinders at home should be unstoppable, but they're going up against a tough Buffalo defense. They're playing with confidence. I'm really looking forward to this game.
Paul, what's your favorite game on the College Board?
I am picking, oh, wow, it's a trend buster for sure. After last week, Clemson on the ropes, North Carolina had them down to the last minute, the last play almost. They're coming back, and they're playing at Georgia Tech. Let me tell you, Georgia Tech put up 2 points against Temple, lost in overtime against the Citadel. They're 0-7 against the spread, 0-6 on grass, 0-4 in the last home games. I am taking Georgia Tech to cover the 10 against North Carolina.
All right. Hey, Paul, we appreciate it. We'll see you down there tomorrow, okay?
Sounds good.
There you go. Paul Amandi. Tomorrow, we're live at the Golden Circle Sports Bar watching the Vegas Golden Knights open their season during all of the VGK home games. $3 beers. That's right. $3 beers right there on the strip, and parking is free right behind the TI.
Continue the Cofield and Company conversation on Facebook. Friend us at ESPN Las Vegas.